Some of the 2012 presidential election's most memorable moments came from Republican candidate Mitt Romney, whose gaffes often went viral, thanks in large part to President Obama's reelection campaign team. But behind the scenes, the president's campaign had problems of its own, including feuding staff members, the president's low approval ratings, and the poor performance, his poor performance in the first debate. In his latest book called The Message, The Reselling of President Obama, Richard Wolff, MSNBC.com's executive editor and the former senior White House correspondent at Newsweek, writes about how President Obama clinched the 2012 election despite his campaign's problems. It's published by 12, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Richard Wolff back to our show. Hello.
Leonard, it's an honor to be back, and I'm a big fan of the show.
There's already talk that the 2016 campaign has begun. Yes. When did Mr. Obama's reelection campaign officially begin?
You know, they really started it in the depths of the worst possible point in the first term, which was after the last debt ceiling crisis. You know, we were about to go through another one, but they went out there and they did this whole benchmark polling. So really, we're talking a good 2 years out, 18 months out. And what they found was a pretty dismal state of affairs. Voters were not happy. They were ready for change. And, you know, they like to brush over it, but it was a very dark period for them.
And he's facing the same problem once again. The majority of Americans believe that he is not doing well in dealing with the economy.
It's not quite as bad as it was at that time. Of course, we'll have to see how the next few months unfold. But some of the same points are being raised about him, about strength of leadership and character, about is he caught by Congress? Where's he trying to take the country? And of course, where's the magic gone, right? That's the big question. How can they have been so good at campaigning and struggle so much at governing? That is a perennial question.
Was he helped at all by the way the Republicans handled that debt ceiling problem?
Well, ultimately they were, but they came at it from a very strategic perspective. What they did was they said, we need to rebuild and be very focused about putting them on the back foot, about saying, pass this bill and we can't wait. We're not seeing any similar strategy today, and that's a big contrast with the campaign where they were faced with these overwhelming odds and they were very methodical about how to move forward.
Well, I think that he's counting on the next elections for Congress, at turning things around perhaps. Bringing more Democrats into the House. But in 2010, the Democrats lost the House.
Exactly.
And to some degree was that President Obama's fault?
Oh, well, you could argue he should have seen it coming. And actually, what his advisors said at the time of the economic collapse is, well, you're going to lose the next congressional elections. I mean, you may as well have thrown it because out of your control, but this economy is going to punish you very badly. And the economy, you know, as I point out in this book, the economy was still their toughest opponent in the last election, the last presidential election.
You're right that the president often suffered cold, dark moods during that time.
Yeah.
How was he expressing that anger and depression?
So he is not someone who is prone to sort of purple rages. He's not a screamer like President Clinton was, and he will often chill a room. But this period at the start, really at the start of the reelection effort, was marked by these long, almost sort of depressing moments. The staff felt burnt out. They felt that he wasn't having any energy or momentum. He wasn't invested in the election. And he came out from the summer after the debt ceiling in a much different mood. He wanted to fight back. He wanted to be aggressive. And that was certainly reflected in his tone. But that was a very, very low point for him personally, for them politically.
How did he respond to the media, who were often critical?
Very frustrated. That's his pet peeve. It is often with presidents. But
there's no president that ever loved the press.
Not really. And they're feeling it right now. Look, I can tell you right now from the White House reaction to my book, they don't want you to read this stuff. They won't want you to read about how complicated their personal relationships were in the infighting. That's maybe true of all White Houses, but they're going through a bad patch. And these kinds of stories, they don't consider to be terribly helpful, even though it came from them. The president, look, he likes to say, at the time, he couldn't understand why he felt the press was doing such a bad job. So he gets to be the media critic in chief.
In the early polling, his numbers were down among white, independent women, lower income white voters, and voters age 18 to 34. those groups had provided some of his key votes during the 2008 campaign. Why was he losing them?
They felt that he wasn't focused on what they really needed. He wasn't focused on the economy. He wasn't really reflecting their needs and their concerns. You know, the interesting thing, when you look back with a book, you think, having gone through an election, you've read it all and seen it all. At the time, the White House was saying they were doing just fine with those voters. Their core voters, their actual inside data, they were really struggling, and they just weren't connecting. They didn't feel a personal connection to him.
There was a fear that people who had voted for him were just going to stay away from the election.
Right.
But didn't he get a bounce after it was revealed that Osama bin Laden had been killed?
He got a temporary bounce, it's true. But that wasn't nearly enough to drive people out. What they had to put together was this formidable and really historic ground game. The turnout the vote operation was one of the really well-functioning pieces of the campaign. And not coincidentally, it was run very independently. So it had to link in with the facts, with the stories, with events like bin Laden. But actually, they were their own machine.
Well, the economy was improving, although perhaps not as quickly as people would have liked.
It was
improving. Why wasn't he being given any credit?
Well, he was gaining some credit. His numbers were rising on the economy, and certainly that undermined Mitt Romney's case that he was the guy who could fix the economy. And they were very keen about stressing that in these ads, and a lot of the book is about the ad campaign, that he wasn't taking credit for it, that it was actually the American worker who had restored the economy, the auto workers that had restored Detroit, not him. And so they were very careful and nuanced. They had to really debate a lot with themselves about, could they say the economy was back? Was it coming back? Well, they wanted to say it was morning in America, but it really wasn't quite there.
And he couldn't take that slogan.
He tried.
Richard Wolff's latest book is The Message, The Reselling of President Obama. It's published by 12. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. David Plouffe, the Obama campaign's chief strategist during the 2008 campaign, returned to the White House in 2011. What role does a chief strategist play in a campaign like that?
You know, David Plouffe was really the de facto campaign manager. And the fact that, you know, he played that role in the first campaign, but the fact that he wasn't the explicit campaign manager this time around led to a lot of problems. This was a senior campaign team that was really being run by the White House, by the guy who was sitting in the office next to President Obama. And yet he wasn't present in Chicago, where the Obama campaign was headquartered. And the communication between the two led to all sorts of rivalries and problems. So
you're talking about David Axelrod.
No, actually, David Plouffe. David Plouffe was, you know, as the guy pulling the strings, he was really pulling those strings through Jim Messina, his campaign manager, the technical campaign manager. He had been a sort of chief operating officer in the 2008 effort. But because Plouffe wasn't there, Messina was saying, well, Plouffe wants this and Plouffe wants that. There were big, big disputes in Chicago about whether that was true, whether he was really speaking for Plouffe, who was really calling the shots. And that led to really, you know, they had a difficult situation anyway, but it was made all the harder by these differences of having the White House running it, but not actually present.
Well, how did Plouffe and David Axelrod work? Did they work well together?
So these are two old friends. They were business partners in consulting together, and obviously they'd been very close and present together in 2008. That sense of camaraderie had really frayed. Plouffe had made money while Axelrod was in the White House in the first couple of years, those tumultuous couple of years in the White House at the beginning of the term. And then Plouffe returned, and essentially, Axelrod was edged out. He was edged out physically. He wanted to stay on perhaps a bit longer, and he got pushed out early. And Plouffe took on a lot of the roles that Axelrod had taken on, and their relationship became strained on a number of different fronts.
Well, you're right that Axelrod had created Mr. Obama as a candidate, and now Plouffe was coming in with a different plan?
A different plan, and one who was in unquestionable control of everything, of messaging, of strategy, of the president's schedule. Yes, I think a lot of people in the White House, as they told me, were shocked at the way Axelrod had been pushed out when they felt that really the president could and should have been more loyal to the guy who brought him out of being a state senator in Illinois.
Was the feeling that there was had to be a different message for this campaign?
Absolutely. Look, the first couple of years in the White House were a disaster in terms of the message. The president
Hope
himself
had been the message of the campaign in 2008.
Of the first campaign, yes, but the first couple of years in office was so difficult with the economy, so difficult with healthcare, so difficult with the Recovery Act. There was widespread frustration that they weren't breaking through. There wasn't discipline, there wasn't control, and that they weren't well placed to start up for the campaign. They thought that Axelrod getting out of Washington would be a help, and I think that's probably true. But that doesn't mean to say that people were happy with being on the outside looking in.
Well, during the first election, Obama had time to focus on his campaign. But then in 2012, he was president.
Yes.
Which meant having to deal with Congress and appearing strong. Many people felt he looked weak and unpresidential. How did Plouffe deal with those problems?
You know, Plouffe was very single-minded and focused. He's the one, more than anyone, who wanted to take the fight to Republicans. He really galvanized the president's image again as being a strong figure. Pass this bill. We can't wait. All of that focus on the future, that's pure David Plouffe. So a very disciplined figure, very focused, very much into the numbers of, you know, volunteers signed up, voters being registered. So people respected him for that. They respected the fact that they knew where they were headed. And he can take a fair amount of credit for turning things around for the president in the early stages of the campaign.
Before he returned to the White House, I interviewed him at the 92nd Street Y, mm-hmm. and I brought up all the criticism that the president was facing at the time. And he kind of just blew it all off and said, don't worry, everything's okay, we're going to win. This is very early.
Supreme confidence is also one of his major personality traits. In truth, and this is, again, one of the things you can do in going back after the event with a book is to say what was really going on. And there were real perilous moments. There were moments when they'd lost confidence in his performance, in the president's performance. There were moments when Plouffe looked at the numbers and thought, we're in real danger. And again, you know, with hindsight, with the context that you come in as a book author, you can really start pulling at those threads and the relationships, the tensions. How do you overcome people's prejudices about the president? How do you overcome the economy? And how do you overcome the differences between Chicago and the White House? Plouffe, in retrospect, in hindsight, on and off the record, is a very different person from the 92Y David Plouffe.
And how do you, as an author, overcome the tendency to be secretive, as this mm-hmm. White House has been? Do you got people to speak off the record?
I did. Look, I've known these people for a long time. I think a number of them may be regretting it because, you know, they spilled their guts, right? This was the surprising thing in going into
this book. They all
had
complaints, I'm sure.
They all had complaints, not just about the book, but they had complaints about each other. I was not expecting the team camaraderie to have collapsed so comprehensively. And look, they all still believe in this president. They're all very proud of having won in such difficult circumstances. That was no small achievement. But the personal rivalries were really surprising to me. And I think that's the fuller picture of this campaign. It makes that effort all the more extraordinary.
Richard Wolff is executive editor at MSNBC.com. His book on the first Obama campaign, Renegade, was a New York Times bestseller, and now he's written a book about the second campaign called The Message, The Reselling of President Obama. It is published by 12. We will continue our conversation after this. And we are back with Richard Wolff, W-O-L-F-F-E. Another spelling of Wolf, unlike Virginia Woolf's spelling of the name. His latest book, The Message, The Reselling of President Obama, is published by 12. And picking up on what you said earlier, isn't it ironic that the personal rivalries of the Obama 2012 campaign were so intense, considering that Hillary Clinton's primary campaign in 2008 was criticized so roundly for infighting, while Obama's campaign was considered to be cool, calm, and collected.
Yeah, and it is striking. You're quite right to hit on that. It's ironic. I think it's also a reflection of time and power, honestly. I think that's what builds up these sort of resentments and rivalries and sort of who competes to be closest to power. It's sad, actually, to be honest. I find that fascinating on a sort of personal, psychological level to go back into that. But you're right. It's interesting seeing the arc from people who felt that they were going to go in and change politics and finding that they themselves had changed.
McCain's campaign also was cited for a lot of disarray.
That's right.
Well, the Obama campaign was a smooth operation.
Right. Well, I do think that 08 was much smoother than 12. But, you know, if the comparison is with a group of people who really tripped over their own shoelaces, then yes, the Obama team succeeded. They succeeded brilliantly. Their website and their apps did not crash on election day. But when you try and tell a fuller story, you've got to be a little more nuanced and complicated and honest. And the more honest story is that, yes, they had a sense of purpose. Yes, they were more competent than the other side. But these tensions and rivalries and debates, the clash of culture between the old media and the new media, all of that actually happened.
But weren't they helped at all by the fact that it was apparent that Mitt Romney was going to be the candidate for the Republican Party almost from the start? Didn't matter who. It was fun watching all of them go after each other. But he was the most likely candidate for lots of reasons.
Right. He was, and that's who they were banking on. But they also tried to mess with the other side. They liked the prolonged primaries. So one of the fascinating things that I learned was how they tried to they would put out a press release, for instance, trying to sort of talk up Rick Perry and say, oh, or Rick Santorum, oh, you know, we react so angrily to this thing that these preposterous candidates had said, merely to make them look bigger on the Republican side and sustain that contest. So it was really interesting. Yes, they were hoping for Romney. Yes, they got him. They turned him into the avatar of the economy, an economy that they were really running against the economy as their opponent. But they were also playing a very subtle and clever game while they were waiting for Romney to emerge.
The Obama campaign even asked Bill Clinton for advice in November 2011. What did he identify as Romney's weaknesses?
So this was a really fascinating meeting in the Harlem office of Bill Clinton. One of them told me that talking through polling with Bill Clinton was like going to an art gallery with a painter. You know, they could see things that you couldn't otherwise see. He was fascinated by the similarities in the economic argument between 92, his breakthrough campaign, and where the president was, President Obama was today. And so he was really talking about the fair shot, the fair shake, as they like to call it in the Obama side, the plight of the middle class. Those were the kinds of notes he was trying to hit, and how Mitt Romney was, in that sense, an ideal candidate because he just couldn't relate to middle class voters in the same way.
Now, campaigns often, it's noted in the press that there's some panic in a campaign when there are staff changes. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned Plouffe coming in, also Jim Messina, and also deputy campaign manager Stephanie Cutter. And when they came in, it caused some drama.
Yeah, you know, one thing that is really surprising is how this senior team ended up in such bad terms. I mean, they weren't on speaking terms. You had a communications team that couldn't communicate with anyone. And Messina himself was a very polarizing figure. Again, a campaign manager you want as a sort of rallying person, someone who can fire up the troops and everyone gets behind, whether inside the campaign headquarters or more broadly. But he ended up leading a plot to push out Stephanie Cutter, the most high-profile woman on the campaign. You'd see her on these internet videos. And, you know, this stuff didn't get out during the campaign. So by all appearances, they all got along great, and they were all focused on the real goal of reelecting the president. But it was really surprising to me the kind of passions that were there behind the scenes.
In analyzing the election, many people have pointed out that the Romney campaign spent most of its money on ads, while the Obama campaign spent most of its money on all sorts of other things, mm-hmm. social media things. Have they changed? Was that what made their campaign so much more successful despite all of these problems?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, yes, they understood new media very well and they invested very heavily. The Obama campaign had dozens and dozens and dozens of people, actually more people creating web video than they had in their press office. So when we think about communications, we think about people talking to reporters. They were talking directly to voters through Facebook, essentially. So that's one thing. They understood that. They invested very heavily in it. But they were also playing old media very cleverly. They knew they would be at a money disadvantage, so they were very smart in making their dollars go further. They adapted new technology to finding obscure TV shows where they could place their ads. And these are very traditional ads when you think about it. When you look back at the history of ads, they're all trying to sell you the American dream. But they would place those ads in, you know, TV reruns late at night, 3 o'clock in the morning, they would find best value. That's how they use the technology in even in old media terms like TV ads.
And they could have sold some Slim Whitman records at the same time.
Right.
What message did the Obama campaign want to get across in its television commercials?
So a couple of different things. They had it very meticulously blocked out and planned about how they would remind people, first of all, about the bad hand the president had been dealt, about the crisis and how he had helped turn things around. Then redefining Mitt Romney, his record in Massachusetts, and his position on Bain and his record in business. And they would unspool whole series of ads off each theme. So you might see in Ohio an ad that was more related to the car industry that connected to the broader argument about Bain. It was a very, very thorough plan in terms of the TV ads. But, you know, one of the things that fascinated me was looking back at old ads in history and seeing these ads aren't new every cycle. They often draw them from older ads. You know, Axelrod likes to talk about an ad that was used against Barry Goldwater. And, you know, from the Republican primary in that period against LBJ, where LBJ's ads quoted people like Mitt Romney's father, saying that Goldwater was a disaster and would ruin the Republican Party. They loved the ads in history where people were hoisted by their own petard. They were quoted with their own words against them. So there were lots of historical echoes. We think these campaigns happen just in the moment. They don't. They happen in part of a historical record.
It's also a technique that we see on The Daily Show and
sure.
on The Colbert Report, and I'm sure that to some degree the voters who watch those shows were reminded of the sort of thing that they watched those shows for.
You know, I don't know whether people understand the echoes or they resonate at some other level, but they clearly do sort of plug in. When you see some of these, you know, beautifully lit sun-strewn pictures of suburban America and you hear a candidate talk about their promises, they are visually referring back to morning in America. Those ads, those images are burned into our collective memory, whether or not you saw them first time around.
Well, both the Obama campaign and the Romney campaign spent about $1 billion,
mm-hmm.
an incredible
amount of money. Extraordinary
amount of money.
Romney
was getting a lot of money from people like Sheldon Adelson mm-hmm. and the Koch brothers and other wealthy people. Was Romney campaign getting big dollars as well?
Most of the money was being spent by these outside groups. That really caused them problems. For a start, they couldn't buy ads as cheaply, so their dollars didn't go as far. And then they had all this message dissonance. So Karl Rove would hit in terms of the ads he was advising on. And some really vulnerable points for the president. I don't know if you remember the ads where they talk about how the president had been a disappointment. Not that he was the world's most evil person or a socialist or anything like that, but that they'd had high hopes.
He'd promised so much.
He promised so much and he'd somehow failed. And it was really time for something new. That was an almost exact echo of focus group respondents. Those were very powerful. They troubled the Obama campaign deeply, but they were never consistent because you'd hear one ad from a Karl Rove associated group. You'd hear something else from the Romney campaign that was trying to tell you what Romney would do on day one. When you funnel the money, as extraordinary amount as it was, funnel the money through one campaign, one message filter, you get a much more focused message coming through, and that's what the Obama team really did very well.
Were you surprised that Karl Rove would not accept the fact that Romney lost the election on Fox News? Romney's also talk about being totally surprised.
That was one of those priceless moments. And, you know, I actually opened the book with this. On election night, the Obama team themselves, the senior figures in the campaign, had not had time to see it. They celebrated with these mini bar bottles of alcohol in their hotel room. by watching that on video, watching that Karl Rove meltdown. Was it surprising? Yeah, it was surprising. Here is someone, like I interviewed Karl Rove in the White House just before the 2006 midterms, when everyone thought the Republicans were going to lose and lose badly. He told me, he said, "You've got your math, but I've got the math." And Karl Rove still thinks he's got his own math. I mean, you know, at some point, and that's what we saw on Fox News, he had to face up to reality, and it wasn't pleasant.
How important is the choice of the vice presidential running mate? Sarah Palin both helped and hurt John McCain, probably ultimately hurt him more than helped him. Do you think the same is true with Paul Ryan?
Yeah, I think Paul Ryan was a huge mistake for the Romney team. You know, he really could have gone out there dissociating himself from some of the harsh edges of the Republicans in Congress. That's certainly what President Bush did when he was running for president in 2000. He said he was going to be a different kind of Republican. I know people might find that funny now, but Paul Ryan made him joined at the hip with the congressional Republicans, and that was a problem.
And then Romney was also hurt by the 47%.
Clearly, the most damaging thing, the thing that really broke through, you know, this had huge reach. The Obama team didn't even really have to run ads about it. It just got amazing traction, and it was a gift. However, it was also a point of peril, as the Obama team told me. They knew that this was their high watermark, and the next turn of the cycle would be downwards, and that's exactly what happened in the first debate.
Well, the first debate, you describe his performance as disastrous.
Disastrous.
Why do you think he was so, I don't know what word to use, but disengaged?
Well, his debate team told me that they felt they had not served him well. He was constantly asking for guidance about how should he push back? Should he lean in? Should he be aggressive? What would he do in terms of rebutting the false statements they thought they would get from Mitt Romney? And, you know, they kept giving him these long binders. And, of course, you know, you give the president a long binder, he's the kind of guy who's going to read the whole thing. He needed a one sheet. He needed a clear strategy. He didn't get that. He also wasn't engaged. He didn't prepare well. They told me that in the prep sessions, he would become very defensive, very whiny. He'd go into a long litany of how he was right, how the press was wrong, all the kinds of things that he'd been saying in that debt ceiling crisis. And they knew it was going to be a train wreck. They also thought that they, as advisors, bore a lot of the responsibility.
And Romney did score some very good points.
He did.
Not lies, but actual facts.
They did not expect him to run away from his own tax plan. I mean, there were some things that they just could not predict.
Richard Wolff's latest book, The Message, The Reselling of President Obama, is published by 12. Are you preparing now for the next campaign, as the rest of America seems to be?
I am not. I mean, we're fascinated at MSNBC with the 2016 prospect. It's very exciting, but it's still early days. Now, President Obama started out as a candidate in early 2007. We're not quite there yet.
We kind of know who might be running for the Democrats, but have no idea for the Republicans.
Well, apart from Chris Christie.
Thank you so much for being on our show again.
My pleasure. It's been great.